Hello and welcome to Preprints in Motion.
Join us as we sit down with early career researchers and discuss their latest preprint and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia. But we don't stop there. Every month we'll be bringing you special episodes with open science leaders where we discuss how to fix academia. Easy, right? So hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, or find us on Twitter at MotionPod. But for now, let's get into the show.
This week, a topic I personally find fascinating. Transfer of mitochondria by macrophages with Chelsea Kidwell and Joey Casolini.
Two guests again today, and I love having multiple people on because it's always more fun when you've got more than one person on, and it keeps them in check a little bit better. So we've got Chelsea and Joey, and I think we should start by you introducing yourselves so people can hear your voice. So Chelsea, why don't you go first? Tell us a little bit about you.
Hi. I'm Chelsea Kidwell. I'm a postdoc in Mina Rowe Johnson's lab at University of Utah in the biochemistry department. Really excited to talk about our work today. Joey and I co-authored a preprint on BioArchive, and it's been really exciting to share our work.
And Joey?
Yeah, so my name is Joey Casolini. I'm a fifth-year graduate student in the same lab, so the Mina Rowe Johnson lab here in the biochemistry department in Salt Lake City. I don't know what else to say about myself other than just happy to be here. It'll be fun to chat.
Fifth-year grad student always gets me. So in the UK, we only do 3 years and then we're out. We're kicked out the door. So five years. I can't imagine 5 years.
Yeah. So what do you guys have to publish? Is there a requirement for that?
No.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Because most departments here require a publication, at least one.
Well, then you need those 5 years.
Yeah. And some people go much longer than five.
Yeah, I've heard. The American system is never ending, it seems.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
So you grew up with alternative schooling. And
yeah.
So Emma's asked if that makes going to grad school easier or harder, but I don't think you can answer that. So how did you find that move into grad school from that kind of background?
Yeah, it's been a weird and challenging, but also, I don't know, it's been a mix of things, you know? I mean, it was weird coming to grad school. So, those of you that don't know, which is literally everyone listening, I've always been an alternative school. I've literally, you know, if you imagine the most hippie schools in the world, you know, I literally had gardening instead of math growing up, right?
That sounds better.
Yeah, it was great. And I kind of just stuck with that general format of sort of alternative ways of learning because I learned better in those environments. And fortunately, my parents recognized that and they kind of shelved me off to all these weird hippie schools. And I kind of stuck with that all the way through college, where I went to the Evergreen State College in Washington State in the States. And so I never had a grade growing up. The first grade I got was when I came here. And honestly, I didn't really know how to interpret it. It was confusing to me because, you know, it's a letter then with either a plus symbol or a minus. And I just didn't, you know, because I was used to growing up and, you know, at the end of the semester or whatever, I get an evaluation. And so coming in here, they'd be like, oh, here's an A. And I'd be like, okay, great. But like, how did you think I did? Where everyone else was so used to that. And so for me, it was a real transition to come in here and then actually start thinking about a GPA, which I've literally always made fun of. And, but now it kind of matters. And so it's been good and bad. It definitely has made it hard for me to understand and appreciate how I was doing in classes because I wasn't actually interacting with my teachers about how they thought I was doing. Mm-hmm. And so like, it's a different level of validation, you know, it's a different kind of validation. And so it was a little bit challenging for me for sure.
I mean, I think everyone finds grad school a bit, you know, good and bad. It's definitely, I mean, Chelsea probably agrees. There's ups and downs, and I don't think, doesn't really matter what your background is. I think there's always those challenges, and it's such a different system, even from like normal schooling and university system. It's so different jumping into that. It's like jumping into a sea, really, isn't it? You just kind of drowned immediately as soon as you get in there, and then you have to kind of fight your way back up to the surface.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think grad school is a really interesting experience because it's really about learning how to synthesize information as opposed to reading something in a textbook, which then gives you the answers. You know, it's about asking questions and determining your own answers on things. It's a true shift as far as educational systems go.
Which kind of leads us nicely into the preprint, actually. So this is what you've done, right? You've asked some questions and you've done some really, really cool work. So the work you've done is all about macrophages transferring mitochondria. Really cool. Lots of questions about that. But I guess to start with, could you just give us a bit of a background as to why macrophage transfer mitochondria?
Well, I think that's the golden question of why do macrophages transfer mitochondria, right? So I think our work doesn't really go into depth about that part of it. We study a lot about the donor side of things and kind of the dynamics within the cell, but why do they do this? You know, it could just be that macrophages perhaps get rid of damaged or old mitochondria, and that cancer cells are just very receptive, right? They're utilizing a lot of energy to grow. And so they're just like, give me everything I can take. Or it could be an active process, right? Where it's some sort of communication that's perhaps purposeful, if that makes sense. But yeah, I think, you know, we would love to know that answer and know, understand more about why mitochondrial transfer at large happens. You know, a lot of what has been studied is with stressed cells, and one could argue that cancer cells are stressed. So, you know, maybe it's more on the recipient side than the donor side, but I think a lot of open-ended questions there for sure.
How long has this been known about? Because I first came across this probably earlier this year, actually. So to me, it's this very new phenomenon. Is it that new, or has it been known about for quite a while?
So I think one of the first documentations of kind of sharing of organelles came from a early 2000s paper where they looked at a structure called tunneling nanotubes, and that's when it was first described. And they found that mitochondria, lysosomes were transferred, other kind of cellular components can be transferred through this kind of conduit between cells. So I think that's one of the first examples of that. And then from there, it just kind of, you know, you can find, you know, if you do a literature search, there's a lot of papers looking at mitochondrial transfer, actually.
Okay. It's more established than that. More established than
yeah.
That it's just one of those things that's really interesting because you tell someone about it. I mean, our story is so fun and easy to tell. You know, you hear the words mitochondrial transfer and people automatically sort of start listening to what you're talking about. And then so whenever we give talks, we have to be very clear that we did not discover this. You know, other people have identified this, you know, this has been, you know, 15 or 20 years by now. And so there is, you know, a fair amount known about it, but there's a lot of holes in the field, which is what we tried to address. But.
And having a story like that is great when you present. It's a story totally. We all want.
Yeah, definitely.
So you've looked at this in terms of macrophages transferring to cancer cells. Does this happen to other cells too?
Yeah, definitely. So this phenomenon has been observed in many different conditions. Essentially, researchers create a stressed system, and then they look at this phenomenon, meaning that, so this has been observed in situations, also cancer, but also tissue damage has been shown to induce mitochondrial transfer, or cells that are damaged, particularly in the lung, have been shown to uptake mitochondria. So there's been many different recipient cells, and there have also been multiple different donors identified as well. So macrophages aren't the only cells that transfer, and cancer cells definitely aren't the only cells that receive.
I think the paper I read, it was neurons that were receiving the...
Was that also from macrophages or microglia?
Yeah, it's from macrophages, yeah. So how did you start working on this? I mean, this is, like we kind of said, it's one of those things that a lot of people aren't actually aware of. So how do you come about to start on this?
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, I'm a fifth year graduate student in this lab, and the lab is only 5 years old. So me and one other grad student were the first students to join the lab. And so our PI, Mina Rowe Johnson, in her postdoc, prior to her starting her lab here, she identified that macrophages transfer bulk cytoplasm to cancer cells, and that those cells, you know, basically exhibit kind of aggressive phenotypes, just to put it simply. And so when I joined the lab, she basically asked me what I was interested in, what I wanted to do. And I definitely wanted to follow up her study of showing the cytoplasmic transfer. So we started looking through the field and kind of thought about, well, what else has been shown to be transferred? And then that's how we came across the mitochondria. So basically, after my rotation, I kind of just jumped into it. And then Chelsea joined shortly after I joined. And then we put our heads together and said, let's do this.
There's something else I like about the US system is you actually get to choose your own project a bit more than we do. We kind of just jump in on something that's already decided. So one of the downsides to kind of the voice medium is that we can't show off all the really pretty microscopy pictures you've got in the preprint, because you've done some really cool microscopy. So I mean, when you're doing this, do you actually get to see the mitochondria being transferred over when you're doing these kind of imaging?
We wish. We've tried really hard, Joey and I both, to kind of capture transfer happening. And there's a couple of reasons why it's been difficult. Mainly, it's a rare event, basically, right? It happens on average to 1% of the co-cultured cancer population. So you can imagine, you know, having a dish of cells, co-cultured cells, and looking, you know, for the perfect spot to capture that transfer and having, you know, really fast time resolution in order to actually see it go from a macrophage to a cancer cell. So that has been extremely challenging. And, you know, we worked probably for 2 solid years trying to get that and didn't come up with it. We can definitely, you know, see afters very readily by microscopy. But yeah, it would be great to be able to manipulate the system perhaps in certain ways to increase transfer, to increase the likelihood of us capturing those events. We would love to see it. We know it's cell contact mediated from doing kind of transwell assays where we separate the two populations and then put them together. But yeah, we haven't visualized it really yet. So
this isn't a microtubule thing. This is cells have to be in sort of physical contact.
Yeah, from our transwell studies, that's what we think. So we can separate them through by a transwell that has a 0.4 micron pore size, and we don't really see transfer in that scenario, only when they're actually physically in contact. So that's what we think is going on. The further mechanism we haven't really dived into yet in terms of like, are they through bona fide TNTs, tunneling nanotubes? But, you know, that's something that's really interesting. And you know, there's so many questions. It's just a matter of figuring out which questions to tackle first. So
that was my next question. So do you have any idea what kind of receptors or signaling pathway is involved in initiating that transfer? Because you mentioned stress cells, so you know, I mean, stress cells must be giving off some kind of signal that says, "Give me your mitochondria."
The short answer is no. At least I'm not familiar of the field really understanding what actually promotes this form of communication. I mean, it could be stress signals. Mitochondrial transfer, for all we know, could be a byproduct of something else that's happening. And it doesn't mean that the biology that we observe downstream isn't real. It just means that this might not be an active, hey, cell, I'm going to transfer a mitochondria to you now. You know, it could be a byproduct of something else. And no, we don't know the kind of promoting kind of receptor ligand interaction.
We've tried to do kind of, you know, RNA-seq, single-cell RNA-seq based assays to look to see if we could get any hits that way. But we didn't really get anything that was super intriguing and interesting in that respect. So more to be explored in that realm as well.
Yeah.
I mean, has anybody looked at the tethering signals on what kind of what holds the cells together and knocking those out and seeing if that kind of disrupts or enhances the processes?
You mean like through the TNTs? Yeah. So there.
Other sort of ECAD hearing type receptors, something like that.
So tunneling nanotubes are another whole field which we've sort of not dedicated a lot of mental energy to for our studies. Just because we were more interested in kind of the more subcellular influences of transfer, either before or after. So we didn't focus on TNTs. But the point is that many people do study TNTs. And I think I'm sure someone that's truly in the TNT field would have a lot more insight to this. But the kind of promoting factors of TNTs aren't particularly clear. There's a protein called MSEC1, I believe is what it's called, which has been shown to be heavily involved in TNT formation. But many people just inhibit actin polymerization to prevent TNT formation, which is actually, to me, a pretty flawed technique, because if you inhibit actin polymerization, you're inhibiting so many other things that it'd be hard to really say that when you inhibit that, then whatever your lack of TNT formation and then kind of having, you know, solid readouts or solid conclusions based on that information, I think would be a little bit confounding.
Yeah, it's a very blunt way of doing it.
I'll just add to that there has also been some evidence that perhaps not in our system, but in other systems, that connexins could be involved there. Making a pore. You know, I can't really think through the logistics of that based off of, you know, the different various sizes of mitochondria that we see come over, but that has been shown in other contexts. So there are potential avenues that we could try to, you know, see if these types of things are also true in our system.
So, I mean, you mentioned size of mitochondria. Do you see, if anyone doesn't know, mitochondria in cells don't actually exist as sort of individuals as you would think from a textbook. They exist as nice long networks, highways, as they're sometimes called. So do you see very long chains cutting through, or is there like a limit on how long a chain you can actually transfer over?
Yeah, we tend to see very small nuggets, little tiny mitochondrion come over. And usually, you know, on the order of one to maybe four at most. And I think, you know, it's been nice actually to explore the donor side and to see how mitochondrial dynamics play into this process, because that's something that, you know, before our study came out, we weren't aware of any studies that actually dove into the donor side of things and actually kind of understood what types of factors can play into transfer on that end. So Joey actually, you know, really pioneered the donor side of stuff and really has pushed forward kind of our understanding of how, you know, if you get a fragmented network in the donor, you're more readily, you see more transfer. So we kind of think that these small nuggets are more readily transferred as opposed to these long interconnected networks that you describe. And that just kind of logically makes sense too, right? Like there's this really long, big thing. It's probably much harder to transfer over to another cell as opposed to a small, tiny, you know, mitochondrion.
So can the same macrophage transfer multiple times, or do you generally just see one cell transferring sort of once and then not doing it again?
Yeah.
I mean, can you even track that? Is that an easy thing?
It kind of goes back to your earlier question of, have you observed transfer? I mean, that's a question that is really interesting too, right? Because if one macrophage transfers multiple times, maybe for some reason that macrophage is more prone to transfer than a neighboring macrophage, which doesn't transfer at all. And the reality is, we just don't know.
Yeah. I think we're trying to get at that answer currently by kind of like marking populations of mitochondria within a macrophage and then doing time-lapse imaging. So for example, if we were to, you know, photoconvert a part of the macrophage network from green to red, just a portion of it, and then, you know, do time-lapse imaging and see red mitochondria, the photoconverted mitochondria from that same macrophage, go to two cells, then that could get at your answer. And that's something we're trying to do. But, you know, you can imagine that because transfer is such a rare event, it can be a needle in a haystack sometimes to find the answer to that question. But we're going to try. We're going to give it a go.
So something you can definitely talk about. Could you tell us a little bit about what these mitochondria are actually, how they function, what makes them different when they're transferred? So, you know, for example, you found that they're depolarized when they're transferred over. So could you tell us just a little bit about the mitochondria themselves?
Okay, cool. So I will say that this is primarily Chelsea's side of the project. I don't want everyone to think that I'm the one that did all of this work. So we see that the transferred mitochondria are depolarized, which is not in conflict with what's talked about in the field, but I kind of think of it as it's adding a new avenue of which transferred mitochondria can change cellular behavior. And because we see that the mitochondria are depolarized, which is indicative of a lack of, you know, sort of canonical mitochondrial function, meaning ATP production. And what's interesting about that is that depolarized mitochondria also produce a lot of reactive oxygen species. So we knew that. So we then asked the question, are the transferred mitochondria, which are depolarized, also producing ROS? And our data suggests that they are producing ROS. And those of you who study ROS, or more particularly those who don't study ROS, a lot of ROS will kill a cell, but a little bit of ROS can actually activate pathways to then promote proliferation, which is our ultimate cellular phenotype. So we did a fair amount of work trying to tether and tie ROS to our proliferative phenotype. And our data suggests that it's through ERK signaling, which is a known ROS induced pathway, or low levels of ROS can induce ERK.
So that would suggest that the cancer cells are kind of actively trying to get mitochondria, right? Because they want to proliferate and grow, rather than there being sort of a mitochondria donating and being kind.
Yeah, right. And so in general, so I mentioned that our experiments kind of add to the model of transfer, because with the way the field generally thinks about why mitochondrial transfer benefits a recipient cell is that the transferred mitochondria fuses with the host network of the mitochondrial networks, you know, or with the host mitochondrial networks, which then ultimately enhances energy production. But our data doesn't suggest that that's what's happening with macrophages and tumor cells, at least in our experiments and the ways that we've observed them. So it just suggests that there's always more to to the puzzle. You know, there's always an additional piece.
That is the tagline to biology, I think. Always more.
Yeah, for sure.
So, I mean, you looked at a breast cancer cell line and you looked at a non-malignant cell line. Did you observe any differences between the two?
Yeah. I mean, I would say that we primarily worked with the breast cancer cells, so I can speak very confidently on those phenotypes and those characterization of that cell type. In terms of the malignant cells, it does look perhaps like they are processing the mitochondria differently than the cancer cell. So definitely predominantly in the cancer cell, we see these kind of mitochondria stick around for long periods of time. We see that they produce ROS with many different metrics. And we think that's leading to proliferation. In the context of the non-malignant cell type, we see that it goes over. There is some portion of the mitochondria that the donated mitochondria that stick around for a while. So that's very similar. But we also see that the transfer rates are lower and there may be signatures of kind of diffusion or fusion with the host mitochondrial network in the case of the non-malignant cells. So there's much more to be explored there. And we're really interested in that and kind of going down that avenue. I think it would be really interesting, you know, if they're processed the same or if they're processed differently. So we're really, really excited to kind of go down that road.
Just to throw more questions at you, what about aged animals? So mitochondria change with age, which presumably that would have an impact on transfer rates. I mean, macrophage function changes with age too, so that would also potentially have an impact. So, I mean, is that, what do you think is going to go on with age then?
So I've run some pilot experiments with this where we take macrophages from a single, you know, blood donor, and then we age those macrophages throughout the course of about a month. And every week I run a transfer study to see how much transfer occurs. And what I saw was at every time point that I went down the line, I saw significantly more transfer from the macrophages, suggesting that, I mean, it's hard to know, right? Because, you know, you isolate macrophages from human blood or monocytes differentiated into macrophages, and then you age them in vitro. I don't know what that means. I don't know how to apply that to true biological age, you know, because it's sort of, I mean, first of all, it's only a month and they're, you know, exposed to consistent cytokines or consistent concentrations of cytokines with like fresh media, all that stuff. So it's hard to really say, is this true biological age? But what is interesting is that we were talking about how the transferred mitochondria are depolarized. And mitochondrial dysfunction is a pretty canonical readout for age, or age and mitochondrial dysfunction, especially in yeast, have been very, very studied. Because one question that we get is, you know, do macrophages kind of preferentially transfer dysfunctional mitochondria? And that's why they're dysfunctional when they're in the tumor cell. And we don't know. So that's part of what this question was getting at was, you know, how does age influence transfer? And so we haven't tested it exactly, but it does, like that kind of preliminary data does suggest that age is related. And also cancer is an age-related disease. And so it certainly opens up a very interesting line of questioning of sort of, you know, how does age and cancer and mitochondrial transfer all relate and correlate?
Well, I mean, immune dysfunction is also, right, age-related disease. And that
totally
eventually causes a lot of problems. So, I mean, one of the things you looked at was the difference between M1 or M2 macrophages, so pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory macrophages, which is what my PhD was all about. So again, this is something that changes with age. So you showed that M2 macrophages seem to transfer more than the M1 macrophages do. Do you have any idea why that might be?
So we think there's a couple of reasons for that. And the first thing that we did is that we wanted to know, because like Chelsea mentioned earlier, you know, there's basically been little to none, nothing done on the donor side of this interaction. And so what was nice is that when we polarized our macrophages into M2 macrophages, we saw an increase in transfer. And that tells us kind of two things, or it kind of opens up the doors to a couple of things. And one is that it's potentially another mechanism of pro-tumorigenicity associated with M2s, right? But kind of the more interesting thing as far as, you know, research goes, is that we changed the system, right? We did something which then made this event happen more often. So then we could actually dig into the biology. And then, so that's when we started looking at mitochondrial morphologies and correlating macrophage activation or polarization with mitochondrial morphologies, where we see that the mitochondrial networks are more fragmented. And then that's what promoted us to then knock down or overexpress drip one, which promotes fragmentation to then directly influence mitochondrial morphologies, to then look at how morphologies directly influence transfer. So ultimately, we think that M2 transfers more mitochondria because they have more fragmented mitochondrial networks. But other people have shown that M2s also form more tunneling nanotubes. But we didn't look at that directly, but other people have shown that, and which then correlates well with the idea of mitotransfer through TNT.
I mean, well, I'm just thinking about the energy state between sort of M1, M2s. It makes sense for M2s to have more disconnected mitochondria because they don't want to generate a lot of energy. M1's very, very energy intense kind of cells. So, I mean, this kind of leads quite obviously into the next question, which is this therefore a potential therapy to partially treating cancer?
Yeah. You mean trying to inhibit transfer?
Yeah. Inhibit transfer, maybe if we could switch the macrophage class to limit the transfer.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So many people, many people look at macrophage activation and, you know, patient prognosis. And people have done some good work of sort of trying to drive M1 polarization in tumors and showing that, you know, if you have predominantly M1s in a tumor, the tumors, at least in mice, go away. You know, the mouse kind of overall survival and the Kaplan-Meier curves look good. And, you know, M2s are the opposite. So I'm not sure how to directly target transfer. It's complicated for reasons that we already talked about.
I think we're currently trying to move into a more in vivo model, a mouse model. So I think it would be really interesting to kind of try to do different things in terms of activation state in the mouse to see how that influences tumor growth and metastasis and stuff like that. And kind of will lead us perhaps down a road of thinking more about therapies that could help people. So I think that's a really exciting avenue that we're currently pursuing.
Presumably this expands out into a range of other diseases, right? This must be at play in, I mean, neurodegenerative diseases is probably something this is kind of at play in. Do you know how far reaching this goes?
Yeah, mitochondrial transfer has been shown in, you know, a variety of contexts, you know, cancer of all types, basically a majority of the types, brain, you know, solid tumors. I'm not sure about like blood cancers, but perhaps that's out there as well. And a lot of disease states. So like Joey mentioned, you know, there's models for like lung injury, for example, and that mitochondrial transfer has been shown in that context quite nicely. I think, you know, this type of communication occurs in a lot of different contexts, and it's a matter of just labeling the mitochondria and looking for a transfer, and I bet you'd find it. You know, that's kind of my feeling now. So yeah, I think it's a really exciting field, and kind of digging into the cell biology on both sides of it is where I think the field is headed, and I hope that our study has contributed to further understanding how that works.
I mean, I would assume this would be more correlated to chronic diseases where you do get that kind of macrophage switch to not quite so helpful anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. I think another condition in which transfer might happen is just sort of normal biological events when M2s are more prominent. And I think one situation that'd be really interesting would be looking at wound healing, because we know that M2s enter, you know, damage, you know, literally a wound, because they want to shut down the inflammation. They want to increase angiogenesis to then actually start, you know, supplying nutrients to the area. And then maybe they start transferring mitochondria to help the cells that are there to start proliferating more to really heal up the wound. And that I have not seen that in the field, and maybe I'm giving away my follow project, but whatever.
You all didn't hear that.
You're hitting on all of my topics. This is all stuff I do. Yes, I mean that would be really interesting, and that was kind of my next question was, what potential role do these have in more homeostatic functions? Because of course, as M2 macrophages traditionally are those that are associated with just normal homeostasis. When you're an embryo and you're developing into a real life human being, it's the M2 macrophages that are kind of doing all the work. And of course, M2 macrophages are very, very specific to the different tissues. So the ones in your heart are incredibly different from the ones in your lung, for example. I mean, is that something anyone's looked at? That'd be an interesting look at.
Yeah, that would be really interesting. I don't know. Chelsea, do you know?
Not that I'm aware of. There has been maybe one or two other macrophage mitochondrial transfer papers out there, but no, I think that would be really cool. And, you know, there are organisms that are more amenable to this and image-based analysis, such as the zebrafish. So, you know, kind of looking
at... Drosophila, just throwing Drosophila out there.
Drosophila, yeah. And so looking at these different things, like you said, in different tissue contexts and seeing how, you know, an insult kind of influences who infiltrates and who transfers would be super cool, in an animal.
I love the idea of mitotransfer during development. That's really interesting. That'd be a really fun thing to look at.
Okay. So this is at this point, see if John pays attention when he edits. This would be a great point for the little advert we've got. And then we're going to move into the general sort of preprint questions. If John doesn't cut that out, then he clearly hasn't listened to the show at all.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer for everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no, they're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives, so head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows.
So whose decision was it to preprint? Because you mentioned this is a relatively new lab, and generally what I've found is new PIs are a lot more likely to preprint than more established PIs are. But also increasingly I'm seeing postdocs and PhD students say, I want this work preprinted because it benefits me. So whose decision was that? Was there a discussion about that, or was it just done?
I think there was a bit of a discussion. I preprinted my thesis work before it got published through peer review. So I was familiar with BioArchive and just had a great experience with them because I was actually able to transfer my preprint over to the peer review process. And so I was fully on board. Yeah, I think it was a discussion about, like, you know, let's get our work out. Like, it's a complete in quotation package, or at least, you know, we think we found something cool. Let's get it out to the scientific community.
I've just put a talk together where I've said preprints are complete papers. So thank you for saying that. It's not just me shouting about
it. In quotations, yeah.
So, I mean, have you noticed any benefits from preprinting generally? Because, you know, I mean, there's a lot I could rattle off that you generally get, but personal stories always help.
Well, even just for our preprint, we got contacted by, I don't know if they're a group or I'm not sure what to label them as, but they're called ASAP Bio.
Yeah, I work with them.
Oh, do you? Cool. Yeah. So we ended up getting, you know, basically reviewed by them. And it was actually really helpful. You know, it's sort of a dry run of maybe these are the type of questions that we'll get or type of criticisms that we'll get from a, you know, quote unquote real review panel. But so even just that, even just for me as a grad student, that was just really good practice, at least. I mean, not to mention that, you know, it means that there were actually people looking at it with a critical eye. And it, some of the notes were really good. And, you know, did make us think about things and maybe in ways that we hadn't before, you know. So I feel like that in grad school, you get kind of funneled into your column, and then you're sort of sharing ideas and data with the same people over and over and over again, which can be good because then they really know your project. So they really know how to kick your butt about it. But it's also just more exposure and you know, preprint. You're just out there, and then people can say stuff or they won't, but it's just more exposure. And I think that more exposure is always good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I was going to bring that up. So I'm glad you did mention it. Because so ASAP Bio have recently started a sort of peer review of preprints. And again, this is kind of something that came up during the pandemic where we saw a number of services that now pre-review preprints, and generally speaking, it depends on the journal, but you can then transfer those reviews to the journal when you submit so that technically you shouldn't have to go through another round of peer review. That's the eventual aim and hope of preprints. Eventually we skip out that delay of traditional peer review. So and you know, you were one of the first ones that they actually did this for through ASAP Bio's program, and you responded to it, which is always good. Always nice when people engage with the process. And yeah, it does seem to have been generally a positive thing. So that's really good. That is really good.
Yeah,
for sure. We really appreciate being selected, first of all, for this process. And then also to the reviewers, you know, for taking the time to kind of meticulously kind of comb through our paper and really critically think about the larger concepts, as well as, you know, the smaller things like a type, you know, somebody got a typo and I was like, thank you, you know, because we had looked at that paper 30 times over and never saw that typo, but it took another person's eyes to really point that out. So, you know, the breadth of it helped us in many ways. And I would just also speak to preprint from a postdoc perspective in terms of, you know, I'm looking to transition out of the lab. So, you know, the peer review process can take a long time, as everyone knows. So, you know, me being able to preprint was a huge deal, right? It went on my resume and it showed that to my future employers that, hey, I have a complete package and it's, you know, in the process instead of just saying submitted to or whatever. They could actually look at that body of work as a complete body of work. So I think that really helped me in terms of showing that I, you know, put something forward, you know, and was able to produce something. So I think that was good professionally.
That's the point I try and push the most, I think, when I'm talking about preprints, is that, because that, I think that is the biggest benefit of preprinting work.
Sure.
But that leads us quite nicely into my next question. So the other thing I quite like to talk about and get people's opinion on is just academia in general, like what it's like to be in academia, because a lot of people who aren't academics seem to have a very rose-tinted view of what it's like to be an academic. I've quite often been accused of being very lazy because I can take a Wednesday off if I wanted to. They don't see all the 24-hour working days or the weekend works or anything else that I do, the non-stop. They don't see any of that. Just, you know, take a Wednesday off, so I must be lazy. But what's your experiences of academia be like? I mean, I think it's been broadly positive for most people, but, you know, is there anything you think that really, really needs to change in academia? There's lots of things I can think of, but
yeah,
I shouldn't rant.
I guess my big thing, and I think there's been a lot of pushes forward on this particular initiative, is diversity, right? Diversity in terms of genders and, you know, LGBTQIA+ people. And just, you know, yeah, I think diverse opinions always are beneficial to, you know, institutes, labs, everything on every level. So that's the one thing I would say. I hope for change in that avenue in the next 50 years. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think in addition to that, I think this pandemic has really demonstrated this well to me of how, you know, in academia, we're so focused on discovery and very kind of erudite discussion of our work, that as science becomes and technology just becomes more and more complicated, it actually does become harder to describe. And so there's so much focus on that sort of truly academic value of academia, that there's so much less focus on making sure people understand what we do. And then so when something like a pandemic hits, and there is a pretty, you know, phenomenal new technology of something called an mRNA vaccine, then people say, well, I don't get it. I'm scared of it.
Yeah.
I don't want anything to do with that. And that's a huge bummer. You know, it's a huge, huge bummer. And science isn't going to be getting less complicated. You know, our technology is going to continue to advance and it will become harder to describe to the public. And I really hope academia starts putting a strong emphasis on public engagement.
Yeah, that
definitely
is.
Yeah.
I think the pandemic has highlighted that brilliantly. Maybe that's not terribly. It's highlighted highlighted how bad it currently is.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, some of the work I've looked at some of this, a few pieces of work now, and generally speaking, during the pandemic, people were quite good. People did actually sort of stick to their fields and what they know. But of course, then at the start of the pandemic, we had all those physicists who suddenly thought they were immunologists and epidemiologists. And then we moved on to the epidemiologists who thought they were immunologists.
Yeah.
So I think that has been the thing that has annoyed me most, actually, over the pandemic, is all these people who sort of are giving a platform when they shouldn't be given a platform necessarily.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to mention all the Nobel Prize winners who seem to think they know everything and are horribly, horribly wrong and will probably now sue me.
Yeah.
As they're currently doing to other people. So, I mean, what do you think the answer to that is? Because I think one of the things that, I can only really speak about the UK system, but one of the things that seems missing to me is a sort of proper training route for not just PhD students, but also postdocs. I mean, postdocs, one of the reasons we get paid so little as a postdoc is because we're being trained. It's a training position. It's not. It's just an excuse to not pay us any money. But in both of those sets, we don't have a proper training route. We get journal clubs in the UK. That is our training. And then it depends on what your PI does. Some PIs might give you papers to review. You might get to write a grant. That's your training, if you're lucky. But I think we need like a proper sort of system in place where you have modules, and you have, say, a module on scientific publishing, a module on how to review a paper, because journal clubs, in my experience, don't teach you to actually reread or review a paper. It's mainly just, let's talk about these images, and then we're done.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is there an answer? Do you think there's an answer to how we can fix some of those issues?
Well, I think when it comes to the communication thing, I think a powerful tool could be some probably institutional-wide requirement for everyone in every lab to commit a certain number of hours to basically community outreach. And that could be, you know, teaching a, you know, high school class or even like a middle school class of whatever it is that they talk about, where they really have to, you know, distill things down to the most meaningful information that's highly digestible. And I think that kind of thing could be useful. I don't know how you'd implement it if it's, you know, institutional wide. You know, I'm not sure how that works. Not every institution is in a place with, you know, tons of schools, and not every institution is in a place with a ton of community, you know. I mean, think of like Cold Spring Harbor, you know, out there, Cold Spring, New York. It's like they're in the middle of nowhere, you know. So anyways, because as a grad student, it's like I was forced to take a certain slew of courses, right, in my first couple of years. And if part of that was literally, you know, scientific communication to community members, I could find that, I think that might help with that.
Yeah. I would say that, yeah. I mean, I think grad students actually, you know, there is an avenue for kind of integrating like, you know, more practical based courses perhaps that are required for each cohort or whatever it is. For postdocs, it's a bit more fuzzy, I think, you know, because you're training, but like training is very ill-defined, like you mentioned. And, you know, we don't take courses, right? Like they don't require us to do any type of coursework. So I think that's tougher. And I think, you know, I agree with all of the things that you guys have mentioned. I think also exposure to like what it looks like on a day-to-day basis to be a PI and actually what they do, right? Because you have your regular meetings with them and you see them in certain contexts, but like what are they actually doing day by day, and how do they kind of approach grant writing or, you know, paper formulation or whatever it is? I think that's would be really practical information that people need to know, right? Instead of kind of getting a PI position, for example, and jumping into the deep end and being like, okay, now what do I do? Yeah. Like, because I don't actually know what the job entails. And true for, you know, industry positions. I think that, you know, there's not enough exposure to industry positions and what that also entails. And just the options out there, right? You know, we're kind of funneled into this system where it's like, do this, go to grad school, do a postdoc, and then you're going to become a PI. But unfortunately, the reality of the situation is that there are very few PI positions out there, right? So like, what do the rest of us do? So, you know, knowing what the options are in terms of scientific communication, teaching, or industry scientist positions, you know, I think that would all be really valuable everywhere where we do science, right? So I hope that comes in the future, perhaps just, you know, postdocs and grad students pushing for that, and kind of as new faculty comes in, they see the need and they want to fill that need, fill that gap, right?
Yeah. I mean, the finding out what it's like to be a PI is, that would be hugely beneficial. So I am, earlier this year, I sort of submitted my first senior author paper, which is a whole experience. So the papers I'd submitted before, I wrote the paper, but then the PI did all the work, right? They deal with the journal, they essentially deal with the reviewers. So doing all that for the first time, terrifying. Like, how do you respond to reviewers? I'd never done that before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think exposure to that at all levels, right? Like as a young grad student, as a senior grad student, like we should be able to see the process in real time, even if we're not fully involved in it, because, you know, knowledge is the key, right? We know what to expect and we can gear ourselves up to meet the challenges. So, but we first have to be exposed to these things, you know, I would say like, let's advocate for ourselves to be exposed to all of the steps of this process. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah. I am trying to unionize the postdocs in the UK at the moment.
Get some kind of organization.
That's a good idea.
It's really hard. We've got a Slack group actually now for the UK postdocs that I started up. We've got a couple of hundred
people
in there now.
That's
but yeah, I do think we should unionize. But the problem with postdocs is because we're so siloed, it's really, really difficult to get us together to actually be a unit and work together, because we don't want to. We're stuck in our lab. We want to do our own thing. We don't want to be distracted from the lab, because then we're not going to get to do our PI position. We all want that PI position. And it's so difficult to get postdocs to do anything together.
Yeah, it is. That's also my experience that, you know, oh, I can't make time for that, you know, 45 minute meeting. It's not possible. So, but, you know, we all have to realize it's probably in our best interest, right? To kind of team up together and have one voice about how we want our training to go.
It is.
Yeah.
So I would normally ask Emma if I've missed anything. Guys, have I missed anything?
I think we covered a lot. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you. That's good. Thank you so much for coming on. And I enjoyed that a lot. I love
Thank you.
This is super interesting work. And I can't wait to read more.
Yeah.
So hurry up,
Thank
get back
you.
In the lab, do
Thank
more.
Thank you.
Do more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm scheduled on the flow cytometer soon, so I gotta go.
I'm currently imaging on
there we go.
So it's going as we speak.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, this was so fun. And thank you for the invitation and all the interest and the great questions.
And also just pushing preprints forward. Thank you for doing that and putting the awareness out there. Because I think preprints have very little downside to them.
It's
so
like, it's preprint 50% your stuff. Of my job these days.
Yeah, well, good work. Yeah. Good work on trying to push that forward.
Well, thank you so much and have a great day, guys. Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoy listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.